Hey, I'm here. I'm me. It's my show. Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy stuff. Here, mostly. I'm debating doing this. I don't know. I hate Barack Obama as bad as you, but I want to hear this. But you might never listen to me again if I... Well, whatever. It doesn't matter what he's saying. The only thing is, he's pushing for the Iran deal. And he's bringing up the war party who lied us into the Iraq war. And saying, hey, they're the ones behind the no Iran deal. Millions of dollars in ads. By the same people. Israel and their fifth column in America. Who sold you the war in Iraq. Anyway. Yeah, is he right about that? Very right about that. Anyway, so this is going to keep going on for a while. We still have until September before the vote in the Congress. A lot can happen between now and then, no doubt about it. So we'll see what happens. Oh, God. Speaking of which, Barbara Starr, Pentagon flak posing as a CNN reporter, says Iranian warship points weapon at U.S. helicopter. Oh, yeah? Was the helicopter pointing its weapons at the Iranian warship? They have warships? Oh, okay. They have one or two. An Iranian warship briefly pointed a weapon on its deck at a U.S. military helicopter and coalition warship 2 weeks ago in the Gulf of Aden, a defense official said Wednesday. The two ships were just a few hundred yards apart when an Iranian crew member pointed what is believed to have been an on-deck machine gun at the warship and the U.S. military helicopter that had just landed on the coalition ship's deck. However, the coalition warship and helicopter crew quickly noticed there was a cameraman standing right behind the Iranian gunner. Were they just trying to get cool pictures pointing at us? Were they making a propaganda film? Was some guy taking pictures to send to his girlfriend? We don't know, the defense official said. You know what? Good enough for me. As far as they know, some guy was just trying to impress his girlfriend. The entire incident lasted a minute. No shots were fired. Doesn't matter. There's such an important instructive lesson in this. You see it, don't you? Right here? In front of us? If this was a deliberate, provocative act by the Iranians against the Americans, big if, huge if. All caps, bold, italics, underlined, if. Then which Iranians? Whose interests, who in Iran's interests are served by ratcheting up tensions with the United States right now? The Revolutionary Guard Corps. The Quds Force. The right wing of the right wing in Iran. The people who our war party claims are the ones with all the power and authority, and the ones that they claim that they're the most afraid of. The ones that they're constantly predicting are going to, get one nuke and then end the world with it in order to bring back the 12th Imam and whatever crap. And so then the obvious question that comes next is, well, in whose interests are the American war party serving in Iran by opposing the deal on this side? Right, the same guys. The IRGC and the Quds Force and the right wing of the right wing. The moderates are the enemy of the war party on both sides. And so, never even mind being a front for Israel. Here we go, we've got the neocons unwittingly, as always, well, as half the time, serving the interests of the right wing in Iran. Like that time that they lied us into war with Iraq. Based on lies told to them by Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi. And, well, that's what the CIA and the DIA say. You can read about it in the foreword. You can read about it in the Wall Street Journal. As always, the American War Party are serving the interests of the people that they claim are their very worst enemies. Whether it's, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or would-be Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which didn't exist at the time, or the Iranians. In Iraq. And for that matter, you know, kind of helping them in Syria by forcing Assad to be even more dependent on them than he already was. And anyway. So yeah, today at the, on the, whichever preposition you prefer, I don't care. Today near the Scott Horton Show, Justin Logan will be on to talk about what is actually true and not true about Iran and their power and influence in the Middle East. I really like Justin Logan. I've been reading him a long time. He's one of the best guys at Cato. And I've never interviewed him before. How do you like that? You know, I think I tried to interview him a couple of times and it didn't work out. And then, I don't know. But now he's going to be on the show. Isn't that cool? We're running an article by him on antiwar.com today. How Washington has inflated the Iran threat. By Justin Logan. Also today on the show, we're going to have Anthony Weller. His father, George Weller, was the first into Nagasaki after Harry Truman nuked it. And the U.S. government censored all of his journalism. But then many decades later, his son Anthony edited and published his father's work. Oh, yeah. It's the 70th anniversary of the Nukins. And so a bigger deal than usual, which I always cover it every year this time of year. But I'm going to try to also get Christian Appy on. He's got one that we're running on antiwar.com today. America's Hiroshima and Nagasaki 70 years later. That's interesting. America's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's about what it all means to the American people. What the American people believe about it, know about it, question mark, think about it after all this time. You'll be amazed to find out that they're mostly horrible on the facts and morality. But then again, they're lied to. They're so, so lied to. And so anyway, it is what it is. So we'll be talking about some of that. Also, I still have invites out to Matthew Akins and to Anand Gopal to please, please, please come and cover the Afghan and Yemen wars for us on the show, guys. We need you here to cover these wars. Oh, yeah, America's war in Yemen is just, oh, friggin' hell. You know what? Go and read Ryan Cooper. He's on antiwar.com today in the viewpoints. The U.S. is enabling a terrible mistake in Yemen. It's a lot worse than a mistake, dude, but anyway. Good enough write-up. And Matt Purple has one at the National Interest that's really good, too, although he makes an error and scolds the Houthis for overthrowing an elected government. When if Hadi was elected president of Yemen, then I was elected president of Yemen. Why not? But anyway, he was elected by Hillary Clinton. Other than that, though, it's a great article. And there's a huge humanitarian crisis going on. I'm also trying to get someone from Oxfam to come on to talk about the humanitarian crisis. There's a full-scale blockade on this tiny, pitiful, helpless little country, the poorest Arab state, the poorest country in the entire Middle East, Yemen, and 90% of their food came from imports before America and Saudi blockaded the place. So what do you think that means for the tummies of the tiny babies there, huh? In Afghanistan, now that the Taliban has admitted that Mullah Omar is dead, all kinds of things are in flux over there, and I need to get Anand Gopal on to talk about all that, too, so we'll see. I don't know. But anyway, it's the Scott Horton Show, and I'll be back in a minute. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. liberty.me. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Okay, guys, welcome back. All right, so we're full up. I fished my wish, and Ongopal is going to be on. In 45 minutes, or, well, 40. Yeah, 45. I'm Scott Horton, and, Justin Logan coming up, and then Anand Gopal and, Anthony Weller. So that should be a good one. Hey, did you hear the new ad? It just ran. I should have it queued up to run again for you. Did you hear it? Master Samurai Tech? Here, let me play it for you again. This is my new spot. And in fact, I have another new advertiser coming on who, runs an engineering firm. That's going to be starting up in a couple of weeks. So I'm really excited for that too. If you want to advertise on the show, you can advertise on the show. I'm cheap. We can work it out. Let me see here. I'm the good kind of cheap. You know what I mean? Yeah. Right? Okay. Spots and this one. Check it out. Oops. Guess I gotta hit the button and turn up the slider and all that, don't I? Oy. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Cool, right? Yeah, man. Very cool. That's what I mean. Okay, so it's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And I want to talk about the police state stuff in Yemen. Well, I'll just tell you, UAE, I think they're saying, has sent tanks to invade now. Where the hell is my invasion of Yemen story? I had it here somewhere, man. Anyway, their ground forces have now entered Yemen. Here, it's on antiwar.com here. Where the hell is it? Foreign ground troops join Yemen war. In the top headlines on antiwar.com, Jason Ditz, tanks, armored vehicles arrive in aid and in first ground deployment. Okay, I can't really help you out much further than that, other than to give you the background of the story again, but I'm gonna move on. Anand is gonna be on to talk about Afghanistan. Weller's gonna be on to talk about nukes. I already mentioned that. Oh, this is my Yemen. I got two Yemen sections messing me up, man. That's Wade Truman stuff, waits, and then, so Iran nuclear deal, that's the deal. Alright. The police state section, I'm sorry, is gonna have to wait. I got so much police state stuff for you, but is it already Thursday? Tomorrow, I swear to God, tomorrow I'm gonna do at least one segment on running down this police state stuff. But I gotta tell you about the Iran nuclear deal. So, I got an email yesterday from a regular listener to this show, who said, hey man, I talked to my, congressman's staff and I says, here's the deal about Iran's nuclear program. And they quickly realized, well, here, let me read it to you. I have the email here. Dun, dun, dun. I guess I don't have it here. Here it is. Talk to Representative Jeb Hensarling's regional director about the Iran deal, as well as Syria, Yemen, Iraq. He ended up not able to defend the party line. So he tried, but quit. He gave up. As a regular listener to this show explained to him how it worked, what Iran's nuclear program is, what the deal is. And the guy finally got, he won him over. You could see it dawn on him. I wasn't just an idiot. I wasn't, you know, just talking out of my ass. I wasn't taking a partisan Democrat stand here. He started getting educated. Toward the end, the congressional staffer, even said that the people calling their office saying to oppose the deal could never articulate a reason why. They just insisted it be opposed. Anyway, the guy got a crash course on how the Iran nuclear program was never a threat and knows much more than he ever wanted to about the NPT and Iran safeguards agreement. It was a fun time. So that was really nice, man. I liked that. And he sent to me in the middle of the show yesterday. I didn't have time to mention it on the show. So I'm very happy to hear that, and I know that there are very few places in the world. Well, there are very few people in America who will cover the Iran nuclear program issue in any kind of a honest or comprehensive sort of a way. And there are very few who have a chip on their shoulder like me in the sense that they are actively attempting to debunk the lies about it. They're actively trying to just fight and win an argument. You know what I mean? Like, there are plenty of wonks who understand the truth and explain the truth well, but they're not fighting about it. They're just trying to explain it. So I'm here to fight about it. Cause, and I have been, for what year is it? I've been covering this issue well for 11 years now, explaining the NPT and the Iranian nuclear program. Ever since I first started reading Gordon Prather. But yet I know that most people know nothing about this. You just know nothing about this. And they go, nuclear threat, Obama capitulate to the mad mullahs, blah, blah, blah. And you're just, eventually you wither under the impression that there's something terrible. But come on, who wants to learn about nuclear this or that? So I'll teach you real quick in just a couple of minutes. Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty since 1968, I think. They've never violated it. They've never been found in violation of it. They've never violated their safeguards agreement. Whatever secret things that they were doing were not illegal. Like digging a giant hole in the ground to one day build a centrifuge facility there. Not illegal. Not in violation of their safeguards agreement. They've never made weapons-grade uranium. They have never been found by the IAEA inspectors who have been safeguarding their nuclear facilities all along to have diverted any nuclear material to any military or other special purpose over and over and over again. They already have a safeguards agreement. They already have inspectors. They're already verified to not be diverting their nuclear material. Even Bill Kristol admitted on Twitter that they're being, quote, rewarded for giving up something they never had. All that's happening now is they're way scaling back their program, their civilian safeguarded legal program that they have, to much smaller, and they're expanding the inspection regime beyond any that's ever existed to make it impossible for them to cheat. Yes, that's good enough for you. Unless you're walking around with a foreign government's dick in your brain all day. Then, yeah, that's okay. Pretty much we're going to give up our Cold War against them if they just really, really verify that they're not making nukes. Yeah, but Scott, Israel says, yeah, the Israelis are lying. Yeah, but I heard some right-wing neocons. Those right-wing neocons are agents of a foreign power. And they're lying. And the reason why they never tell you about safeguards agreements and additional protocols or any of this stuff is because they're lying. Oh my God, there's not snap inspection. There's not guaranteed inspections. Yes, there are too. There's permanent inspections at any place where there's any nuclear material in the country. No, they can't just march right into any nuclear, military base in the country. Oh, boo-hoo. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. Our first guest today is Justin Logan. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Great.
I'm a long-time reader, first-time interviewer. I'm not sure why it's taken me so long to get you on the show. I think I tried a couple times a few years back or something. I don't know. But you write great stuff. I read you all the time. Hey, everybody. Thanks. Justin, he's the guy that coined the phrase, the fallacy of 39. All about, or was it, oh, sorry, 38. So, yeah, I ruined it. The fallacy of 1938 about the neocons and why everything is Munich all the time. Anyway, so you got this very well-done piece here at the Washington Examiner and Cato.org. We're running it today on antiwar.com. How Washington has inflated the Iran threat. And this isn't exactly about the particulars of the centrifuges and the sanctions and all that part of the nuclear deal. Well, the technical part of the nuclear deal, the sanctions, I guess, yeah. But this is about another part of the narrative against the nuclear deal, namely that the deal itself will hand the Middle East over to Iran, basically. They're on the march. They're already taking over the Middle East, and Obama's now just stepping out of their way.
Right. I mean, it's a peculiar thing that there has been very little debate about this deal among arms controllers, on the sort of non-proliferation aspects of the deal, because the administration has been fairly clear that Iran will still be Iran under this deal. It will just happen to be an Iran that's not close to getting a nuclear weapon. And so what we've had, you know, sort of you start losing a war and then you let the mission creep beyond the one that you're already not attaining. They were sort of losing the argument, the opponents of the deal, and then they sort of let the argument creep beyond the one that they weren't winning, into saying that Iran is going to dominate the Middle East, or if you prefer political science jargon, Iran is going to become a regional hegemon. And so if you're a lazy writer like I am, the easy thing to do is to take up the very silliest arguments on the opposite side of the issue. And so I spent probably more verbiage than was needed debunking this idea that Iran is about to be handed the keys to the Middle East.
Well, that's very kind of you to be so modest and self-deprecating and all that. But the truth is that it's not laziness. You took this on because it's a very important talking point for the right-wing war party here, that Iran is the great Satan, and apparently our president is in league with them.
Yeah. Well, that's a little even beyond the scope of what I dealt with. But it's just, you know, the tendency toward threat inflation in Washington is great, right? And all of our various adversaries are 10 feet tall at one time or another. But the practical matter is, even if you grant, and I tried in the article to sort of grant all of the sort of worst case scenarios, say Iran does get $100 or $150 billion of its own money back as a consequence of the agreement, which all the indications are that the number is between 29 and 50 billion, but assume that the sort of hysterics are correct. Assume even that Iran were to attain a nuclear weapons capability. It will still remain a regional power, right? North Korea has a nuclear weapons capability, and nobody says that North Korea dominates the Northeast Asia. Israel has a nuclear weapons capability, and one might add, a very sophisticated military, conventional military that's capable of offensive operations, which the Iranian military is not. And nobody really says that Israel dominates the Middle East for the simple fact that it doesn't dominate the Middle East. If you look through the modern era, starting at about 1500, depending on how you count, there's really only been one state in its region that is sort of agreed upon as being a regional hegemon, and that's the United States in the Western Hemisphere. And for a variety of reasons, historical contingency and otherwise, it's really difficult to attain regional hegemony, right? You can run a scenario where you could say, Wilhelmine Germany might have had a shot at regional hegemony, or certainly Nazi Germany might have had a shot at regional
hegemony. The Soviets in Eastern Europe or in South Asia.
Sure. But it's an exceptionally difficult thing to attain. And when you look at Iran's economic policy, when you look at Iran's neighbors, when you look at the politics of the region, it's just, I think, a really silly argument.
Well, I mean, right off the bat, I mean, you point out, of course, the weakness of their economy. you know, compared to any true regional hegemon. But it's also just a matter of population, right? Like, the Iranians, thanks to the United States of America, have their friends in the Dawa party ruling Iraq right now. But they don't even seem to desire to rule Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, and former Iraqi Sunnistan. They always preferred what they called strong federalism, which is, right, the Biden plan to split Iraq in three and to just keep Shiistan that George W. Bush gave them, that these same neocons who were arguing against the Iran deal argued us into that war to and argue we had to stay and fight that civil war for the Shia, too, once they won the election, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't, the Iranians haven't betrayed really any intention of wanting to dominate all of Sunnistan or dominate, you know, Kuwait or Saudi or whatever, where the population would never welcome them.
Well, I think your question sort of points at a fundamental reality, which is that influence is different than dominance. And Iran certainly has increased influence in Iraq after the American invasion in 2003, and it has sizable influence there, but it doesn't dominate Iraq. Iraq regularly makes decisions from the central government that Iran doesn't like. I don't think Iran is very happy having to fight ISIS. And if you look across the region, from Syria to Yemen to elsewhere, not lending any moral or normative endorsement one way or the other, Iran is really counterpunching, right? They're trying to defend the status quo in Syria, as grotesque as that status quo is, the regime of Bashar Assad. And they're engaged in this sort of soft proxy war with the Gulf Arabs, or to be more specific, the Saudis, struggling for influence in some of the Gulf states. But it makes you sound like a sort of 20th century person, but it also happens to be true that this sort of political noodling around and even engaging in terrorism has never before led a state in history to dominate the region. It's sort of a struggle for influence. So the idea that we would say Iran's poised to dominate the Middle East in a way like the United States dominates the Western Hemisphere is just, you know, to my mind, flatly ridiculous.
Yeah, and again, I'm sorry, I can't help but be repetitive on this, especially when the biggest move they've made this whole time was to send Chalabi to tell the neocons that invading Iraq would be good for Israel.
Well, the Ahmad Chalabi story is a whole sorted one that we could maybe is a separate sidebar from.
But I mean, we're talking about sitting at a table and playing chess. They didn't invade Iraq. They got America to do it for them. So that's our own damn fault for being that level of fool.
We could have been a lot smarter in 2002, 2003. I'd certainly concur with that point.
And I think you and I are both being generous with the term we here, too, since I know you knew better. So did I. But anyway.
Yeah, no one asked me back then. But
No one asked me. I told them anyway, but they didn't listen. But yeah.
Right.
No, but okay, so that's the other thing. And then, so you quote the Tom Cotton thing where they dominate all these capitals, and they're referring to Beirut there, which I thought was funny because just yesterday I interviewed this analyst who talked about just how much influence Iran really does have with Hezbollah. But Hezbollah doesn't rule Beirut. I mean, they're participants in the government in Beirut, but they don't own Lebanon. They own southern Lebanon. That's it.
Right. And even that case overlooks the fact that Hezbollah, thanks in no small part to its relationship with Iran, has had its attention and its resources both sort of diminished and diverted into Syria because Iran is trying to maintain its Syria and has enlisted elements of Hezbollah there. So this idea that all of these actors from Yemen to Lebanon to Iraq are simply sort of puppets of Iran oversimplifies things in a way that I think obscures more than it illuminates.
All right, we'll be right back with more Justin Logan in just a sec, y'all. Cato.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Justin Logan. He is the Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, cato.org. Good on everything as far as I can remember reading by him, which would be probably in the hundreds of articles at this point. Certainly scores and scores and scores. We're talking about propaganda against the Iran agreement, specifically that this agreement will just empower Iran beyond all measure, and they will end up dominating the entire Middle East, a favorite talking point of the American right now and the Israeli right. But now, so let me ask you this. You mentioned before, and we'll go ahead for argument's sake and use the Israeli estimate of $100 billion that they're going to be given, which is, as you said, their money that will stop stealing and go ahead and let them have. Is that it? Or is there another argument that I'm missing somewhere, Justin, about how once Iran's nuclear program goes from a safeguarded electricity program to an additionally protocoled safeguarded nuclear program, civilian nuclear program, that somehow, or the lifting of the sanctions from now on, is there anything else I'm missing that's supposed to add up to Iran's new expanded power in the region here? Because $100 billion isn't a lot of money, really.
Well, it certainly would be to me, but if you're trying to convert it into military power to steamroll your neighbors, it really dries up quickly. It's difficult to disentangle. I mean, I would hope that, you know, you get a few beers into some of these people, they'll concede that this isn't an argument that they really want to sustain. I mean, you have people saying that they're a regional hegemon now, that they dominate five capitals. You have people saying with this deal, they'll become a regional hegemon, without describing what, as you point out, which sort of causal mechanism on the other side of the deal will produce this Iranian regional hegemony. So, in a certain sense, I hope that this is just sort of a useful talking point. I mean, look, I think it bears pointing out that the amount of misinformation that has been put out about this deal is eye-popping, and that is sort of something that's weird for me to utter, because I think that there's misinformation is a sort of pandemic here in Washington, right? We heard an argument that the deal obliges the United States to protect the Iranian nuclear program from Israeli cyber attack. This is just a crazy argument that nobody who's ever read about arms control should have considered for a moment. But we had Senator Rubio from Florida trying to sustain this argument. We had an argument.
Actually, stop at that one for a second, sure. If you would. And I'd like you to continue, so don't let me get you too far off track. But there was some language that sounded sort of kind of something like that. So why doesn't it say what they say it says?
Sure. So if you think about, there are nuclear programs. The United States would prefer information about nuclear technology to stay constrained. And there are all sorts of actors across the globe who would prefer to have access themselves to information about nuclear infrastructure. Iran has a reasonably well-developed nuclear infrastructure. And so some sort of boilerplate language that always goes into these sorts of agreements says, and I forget the exact phrasing, but it's, you know, parties shall be open to helping Iran secure its nuclear program. And this is – so it's not a commitment, right? We will do X or Y or Z, or the French will do X or Y or Z. But all else equal, we would prefer, yes, that nuclear infrastructure stay secure, right, so that we don't replay the AQ Khan experience, et cetera. And anybody who, again, has bothered to read for 20 minutes about this would know that. But instead, we had this little blip of hysteria that just, you know, assumes away reality that the United States is going to cooperate to insulate the Iranian nuclear infrastructure from cyber attacks, not just that have been launched by Israel, but that have been launched by the United States in the recent past, including under the Obama administration. I mean, it just
right.
It is a bizarre idea. And so, you know, we've had fact-checking on these sorts of things over and over. But as anybody who's been in the news business knows, the correction never undoes the damage that's done by the story, right?
Right.
If the A1 story runs and says, you know, Scott Horton is known for, you know, marauding through his neighborhood and kicking dogs, and then a week later, you know, the little box at the bottom of the page says, you know, we mistakenly identified the person as Scott Horton. In fact, it was Justin Logan. You're still going to – people are going to be like, gosh, you're a terrible person. You know, I mean, it never undoes – so there's been, I think, a willingness to purvey this sort of just nonsense and misinformation about the deal, and it's accumulated, right? We've had the 24 days hysteria that doesn't bear at all on the breakout time frame, right? Nothing that – if everything went right for Iran and Iran was acting with sublime malfeasance on all fronts, full spectrum, as well as it could, and it used the 24-day time frame, which is complicated to explain, but there are a number of interlocking intervals that happen if any party to the agreement says that they want to inspect a particular site, that it could, for in the worst-case scenario from the P5+1 point of view, take 24 days to get access to one of those sites. But what those sites could not be or anything that bears on the fuel cycle, because all other aspects of the fuel cycle are locked up and not subject to these restrictions. So this sort of 24 days has been waved around as though they could sort of come up with a bomb in 24 days, which is just physically not possible.
Right, and they never differentiate between so-called suspicious military sites that they want to look at versus already declared and safeguarded nuclear facilities, which is, as you're implying there, their entire program. We already know where all their uranium is. It's already safeguarded, and it's all inspected 24 hours a day.
Right. And so you certainly could have, and, you know, there's been some information that's been correct about this from AIPAC and from other institutions that said, you know, they could do computer research, computer modeling on detonation cores for missile design. That's true, right? It's absolutely true that they could conceivably hide that sort of research. It's also true that if they did successfully hide that sort of research, they still would need to meet the necessary condition for getting a bomb of either obtaining enough high-enriched uranium or plutonium to detonate a bomb. So I think, you know, if the idea is that no such deal is good unless it gives 100% certainty that Iran can never do anything to glean more information about the processes that could be used in combination to produce a nuclear bomb, then that, and maybe, you know, for some people by design, means that there can be no such thing as a good deal, right? Because it's just 100% certainty across a number of interlocking processes is just infeasible. We had this thing about anytime, anywhere inspections. The idea that a sovereign state would give over to the IAEA the ability to go anywhere inside its borders at any time that organization so chose is just eye-poppingly ridiculous. The United States would never do that. I mean, that's the nature of sovereignty, right, is that you retain some control over what's done inside of your borders. So these fanciful sort of unicorn ideas about how arms control could work under the best possible scenarios existing on the planet Earth in 2015 have really poisoned the discourse about how the world works, right? You know, what would be a good deal is if, you know, Iran gave up every aspect of its nuclear infrastructure and all the clerical leadership converted to Christianity. Well, that's just not going to happen. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about poison pills, and I think that when you look at what people are saying would be the aspect of a so-called good deal, there's really nothing other than a poison pill.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when they say good deal, they say there should be no nuclear program left in Iran whatsoever. Even Rand Paul says, oh, it leaves them way too much of their program. Well, really, it leaves them the tiniest rump of a nuclear program. And that's the Netanyahu line, and everybody knows that they're never going to negotiate that away in a million years, if they're being honest. The only way to get Iran to not have a nuclear program at all would be full-scale invasion and occupation. Even the war party admits, if we bombed them, that would just make them decide to build a nuke then. Even Rand admits. That would just make them decide to build a nuke. The only way to stop them from having a nuclear program whatsoever would be to occupy the place with the entire Army and Marine Corps forever. And who wants to do that? Who wants to even admit that that's what they really mean?
Well, I mean, you've had a number of people. You had Norman Podhoretz in the Wall Street Journal. You've had Joshua Moravchik say it. You've had John Bolton say it. So, I mean, I think that it's very telling that the sort of hawkish, the hawkish mainstream in Washington squirms when those articles get published, because people don't want to have the discussion that Obama's trying to have, which is it's this or war. Because people know, you know, even people with really hawkish policy preferences know that, hey, let's fire up another big war in the Middle East is just not a great political selling point right now, right? The Republicans are jockeying for position in the presidential primary, and nobody wants to be, with the exception maybe of Lindsey Graham, the sort of more war in the Middle East candidate. There's a lot of efforts to sort of finesse the issue. Again, this mythical, chimerical better deal that supposedly exists out there, you know, that's what we're in favor of. We're in favor of doing all of these things that would set the United States on an inexorable path toward war, but it won't produce a war, right? And so I think that's why you hear this sort of weird kabuki back and forth about, Hey, I'm not for war. I'm just for pounding the table harder and making a number of demands that anybody who's been paying attention know cannot, will not be met.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I'm sorry I'm keeping you a little bit over time here, but I want to kind of get back to the balance of power thing here real quick with one more question, if I can figure out a good way to phrase it, which is that, you know, as we've talked about, their program isn't really changing. It's just being scaled back more and all that. So the Saudis... never mind the Israelis for a moment. The Saudis had said, you know, they're really against it or suspicious. They've officially endorsed it now. I don't know how half-hearted that is or what. But, you know, what they're not stupid. They know that we're talking about an additional protocol and a shrug here. That if anything is going to change for them to worry about, it seems like it would be America's relationship with Iran in the future. Since in America's Cold War with Iran, the nuclear program is the excuse for most of it. And you know, the last big fake excuse for most of it. So once that issue is put to bed, it seems like that's what Israel and Saudi and Turkey and probably the rest of the Middle East are worried about, is the GCC states and all that, is that, you know, maybe this means an opening between America and Iran and change in their fortunes in terms of American welfare payments and support. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the old, you know, American client state move of let you and him go fight. And it certainly, you know, the Saudis would rather tensions between the United States and Iran stay very high, but the United States continue to look askance at Saudi Arabia's depraved and remarkable governance of its own citizens. And the fact that the Gulf Arab states, or more precisely, I guess, Gulf Arab citizens with a certain amount of negligence on the part of the government have really funded and created the rise of ISIS. So they would like, again, for their sort of geopolitical adversary, Iran, to stay at loggerheads with the United States, both because it, you know, convinces us to cozy up more closely with them and to view our interests as aligning more closely with theirs than certainly I would suggest.
Yeah. All right. Well, sorry for keeping you over time here, but thanks very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, Justin.
Thank you.
All right. So that's Justin Logan. He is the director of foreign policy studies at Cato.org. This article is running in the Viewpoints today at antiwar.com, how Washington has inflated the Iran threat. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back.
I'm sorry for the onion, man. You know, my buddy, who's the audio genius guy, he's working on a new minute-long soundbite musical collage thing to play instead of the onion. He's working on it, so soon we won't have to hear the onion anymore. It's so bad. God. Oh. Kind of even gives me the willies. Anyway, check it out, man. I got Anand Gopal on the line. He is a great reporter, formerly with the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal, and I'm not exactly sure who all he's writing for nowadays, but he wrote the book No Good Men Among the Living about the war in Afghanistan. Welcome back to the show, Anand. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Now, who are you currently working for these days, by the way?
I'm doing freelance work, mostly for magazines. My last piece was in Harper's Magazine.
Oh, okay. Good deal. All right. Oh, yeah. You were you co-wrote the thing with Aikens about the election in Afghanistan last year, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Okay, good deal. All right. So, yeah, now I found this at The Diplomat where they interviewed you, so that helped me out a little bit, reading some of your answers here. But, of course, Afghanistan, it's out of the news mostly, but it's still a huge deal going on over there, and it's in a real state of flux right now, it seems like. All the headlines were saying that the Taliban were making major gains and sacking this base and that base and kidnapping and killing policemen and all this stuff, and then the news breaks that it turns out Mullah Omar is dead, confirmed dead, has been dead for 2 years. So what does it all mean?
Well, on the one hand, it shows that on the ground, the organization, the Taliban, doesn't really need Mullah Omar to be physically present. And really, since 2001, he hasn't been involved in the insurgency. So he's kind of just existed as a figurehead. And yeah, this year is a banner year, militarily speaking. It's a record number of civilians that have been killed. It's been really gruesome on the ground. Politically for the Taliban, however, the death of Mullah Omar means there's the possibility of real splits and fissures.
Oh, that's good. Well, it could be bad, I guess, depending, because some of the other headlines, other than their major military victories lately, was about negotiations for peace. And so I guess a split, you know, right now could be real bad tidings.
Exactly. You know, almost paradoxically, the death of Mullah Omar might actually be a bad thing for the possibility of peace, because it opens up the space for some of the elements within the Taliban leadership who are opposed to peace talks or skeptical of peace talks. It opens up space for them to make a play for power in the movement. And right now there is a power struggle that is going on to determine the successor to Mullah Omar. There's one individual who has essentially claimed the leadership of the movement and has the backing of large portions of the organization, but there are other individuals, including Mullah Omar's family, who reject him, or at least reject the process by which he declared himself to be the leader. And so this remains to be seen. The worst-case scenario would be, down the line, some sort of split, in which case the more extreme forces, such as ISIS, could benefit.
Right. Now, so that was something that I was reading this morning that Ali Soufan, the former FBI agent, put out about how Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, really had a lot kind of hanging around loyalty, continued pledges of loyalty to Mullah Omar as the legitimate caliph. And that this was, you know, a big part of the reason why he would argue that Al-Qaeda guys who had previously been with him had to stay and not switch to supporting ISIS because they had pledged their allegiance to Mullah Omar. But now that he's dead, that throws all that into question as far as the people who have stayed with Al-Qaeda. And it also makes Zawahiri look like a clown because he's been citing Mullah Omar for the last couple of years when he's been dead, which means either Zawahiri was lying or didn't even know.
Well, definitely Zawahiri didn't know. In fact, most people in the Taliban didn't know. It was a closely kept secret. Maybe three or four people in the entire world actually probably had access to Mullah Omar. So, yeah. Almost nobody knew. And certainly it's true that the allegiances to Mullah Omar as a supposed commander of the faithful is something that has kept some people in Al-Qaeda, staying in Al-Qaeda. It doesn't make a huge difference in Afghanistan, where the insurgency in Afghanistan is local. I mean, the foreign elements are there, but they're not a major part of the insurgency. So groups like Al-Qaeda aren't a major part of the insurgency.
Right.
And globally speaking, ISIS has just become such a phenomenon that Al-Qaeda has felt like it needed to find a way to keep recruits and keep members. And one of the ways they were doing that is to try to point to the historical legitimacy in their eyes of Mullah Omar.
Hmm. Well, now, so, yeah, I guess I was even thinking as I was trying to figure out a way to ask that question in the form of a question about, you know, like you were saying, there's not really a bunch of Arab Afghans fighting with the Taliban right now, like back in the 80s or anything like that. So who does this really have an effect on, you know, where it counts as far as the ISIS-Al-Qaeda split? It seems like it'd be among the financiers in Saudi Arabia. But I don't really know how that works, whether they themselves had pledged loyalty to Mullah Omar before, and does that mean that now they'll be free to donate to ISIS instead?
No, I think you've been seeing a shift to some extent in some of the donation patterns. But, you know, I think that we're overplaying perhaps the significance of people's adherence to Al-Qaeda because of Mullah Omar. What we've seen instead in the last couple of years is that people who are drawn to these sorts of causes are moving more and more towards the direction of ISIS. So in Afghanistan, for instance, you had, for the last 4 or 5 years, a number of Taliban splinter groups that have emerged for various reasons, the most common of which was that they have opposed the idea of peace talks, which is the mainstream Taliban leadership is pushing the idea of negotiated settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And so these groups are sort of operating on their own in the last 3 or 4 years. But after ISIS became a phenomenon, they sort of rebranded themselves as ISIS and sort of calling themselves ISIS. And they did that as a way of, you know, attracting attention and perhaps money. And the concern is with the death of Mullah Omar and the sort of debate splits over peace talks, those groups, those splinter groups that are calling themselves ISIS, may get more recruits or may sort of grow more prominent.
Hmm. Yeah, sorry to change the subject, but it's worth pointing out in the middle of all this hype about Iran that the Ayatollahs there in Persia are the biggest obstacle standing between an eventual Islamic state, between you know, the one in former Iraq and Syria and the one that the Taliban were trying to create in Afghanistan. So just remember who's serving who all's agendas here. They overlap sometimes. But anyway, so when it comes down to the sons of Mullah Omar versus, is it Mansour is the guy who is, Mansour, some Mullah Mansour? He's the self-proclaimed
Mansour,
new leader. And now, is that the split, the sons and him? Are they just fighting over the power itself, or they're fighting over the agenda, whether to participate in peace talks or not?
Well, it's a little complicated. There's actually a three-way split.
Uh-huh.
And I think the simplest way to understand it would be that there are people who are opposed to peace talks and people who are in favor of peace talks. And then within the camp that's in favor of peace talks, they're also split between those who want to allow Pakistan to play a major role in the peace talks and those who are suspicious of Pakistan and don't want Pakistan to have any role. So that's kind of the way the split has sort of come about. And Mullah Mansour is the official leader now of the Taliban. He was the deputy of Mullah Omar he was one of the few, supposedly, who actually even knew that Malomer was dead, and he was, you know, writing statements in Malomer's name over the last few years. So he was essentially running things day to day, and that was fine for people. But now that Malomer is officially dead, you know, there's a growing chorus of voices that are saying, well, hold on, you can't just declare yourself the commander of the faithful. You need to have some sort of selection process. You need to call in all the scholars, all the clerics to come and anoint you, and so on and so forth.
Okay, great. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Anon Gopal right after this. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and I got Anand Gopal on. He wrote the book on the Afghan war, man. No good men among the living. Embedded within the Taliban. I assume he won a million awards for it. Pretty sure that's, yeah, must have. We're talking about the death of Mullah Omar, what it means for the Afghan war. It means a lot. So now, when we talk about talks here... talks toward the having of talks or talks toward real issues. I know the Americans, at least according to the New York Times, I think it was, or the Post, the Times, the Americans negotiated for 9 months with a Taliban leader who turned out was an imposter and was just taking their money and screwing them, which is kind of hilarious, but also a little bit tragic. And so I'm assuming that within the talks that are going on, that it's actual Taliban representatives, even if it's only from smaller and smaller factions now. But they're negotiating directly with the government in Kabul. And to what end? They're going to, does anyone think, the allies, is there anything like an idea of how this is supposed to work, where they're going to recognize autonomy in Pashtunistan, or that Pashtunistan and the Taliban will ultimately recognize the authority of Kabul over their lands in exchange for this or that? Because these things are sounding very fanciful to me already, just trying to barely, you know, think from the top of my head of what a deal could even look like.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine any of these things coming to pass. And we should note, by the way, that the peace talks process, which was going ahead, has been suspended completely in the last week because of Mullah Omar's death. You know, as long as there's this power battle within the Taliban leadership, nothing's going to happen. So I don't expect any movement on that front for quite some time. But, you know, in talking to, I can tell you what Taliban leadership want to see, which probably won't be the most realistic thing. But, you know, what they're looking for is essentially they don't want nobody is interested in power sharing. Nobody wants a few ministries or the governorships of a few provinces. What they're asking for is really just a reimagining of the post 2001 order, sort of redrawing up the state. They actually accept, surprisingly to me, accept the Afghan constitution, but they're looking for something. You know, with the troops out, by the way, as long as any troops remain on the ground in Afghanistan, there can be no sort of settlement. That's sort of a main point that gets raised again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there still are, how many, 10,000?
Yeah, about 10,000, and they're not just trainers. They're also special forces operatives who are conducting raids. They're droning people. So it's an actual, you know, President Obama said the war in Afghanistan is over, but that's false. The war in Afghanistan is continuing with these soldiers and with the hundreds of thousands of proxy fighters who are fighting on behalf of the U.S. and also those who are fighting on behalf of Pakistan. Mm-hmm.
and who are armed and led by the U.S.
Yeah, the American proxy forces, I'm referring to militias and to warlords who are armed and created by the U.S. and deployed by the U.S.,
So-called cops, and even worse than that. All right, now,
much worse than that, yeah.
Yeah, okay, but so if the 10,000 left, would the Taliban just walk right into Kabul and say, we're back?
No, I don't think so. You know, as long as the U.S. keeps funding its side, the Afghan government, it doesn't look like the Taliban will be able to sort of kick them out of major cities. And you can see that even now, with all the fighting and all the success the Taliban had on the battlefield, they've still been unable to actually capture a major urban center. And even the Afghan government has more men, more guns, more money. So, that'll just kind of continue. But if the troops leave and there's some kind of settlement, you know, maybe we'll see, a new type of government in place that has elements from all sections of Afghan society. That's, of course, the ideal. That's what people are hoping for, but that's also what the Taliban are asking for.
Well, you know, if ramping up the war from 05 through 11 or 12 was supposed to get rid of these guys but only made them more and more powerful all this time, maybe the draw down to back down to 10,000 troops will actually, you know, work to America and its allies' advantage there in not pushing people into joining the ranks of the Taliban, who were the forefront of the resistance.
Well, definitely, you know, the less troops you have running around and killing people, you know, that's the less recruits the Taliban will have from that. But the problem, on the other hand, is that the warlords that we've unleashed are still there running around and killing people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even if you have some sort of deal between the Taliban leadership and the Afghan government, if those kinds of killings and massacres and human rights violations continue on the ground, then people will still have real grievances with which to fight for. And so they may not call themselves Taliban anymore. They may call themselves Islamic State or whatever else, and they'll keep fighting. So I think this speaks to why you actually need a truth reconciliation process. You need to disarm the warlords. You need a whole host of things that go beyond just having a deal with the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. And now, do the Pashtuns have any kind of political representation of any kind of with any meaning or force other than the Taliban? Because it's not like they're all Taliban. It just seems like it's Taliban are kind of all they have. No?
Well, no. I mean, the Afghan government is predominantly Pashtun, and the president's Pashtun, Karzai before him was Pashtun. So I don't think it's necessarily even an ethnic thing. You know, if you look down the areas where the fighting is the worst, where the Taliban is the strongest, are the Pashtun areas. But those are also the areas that have an entirely Pashtun government.
Yeah. Well, I guess so, I had always read that and sort of been told, I thought, that Karzai, for example, maybe things have changed. I don't know. That Karzai was sort of Pashtun in name only, but there's a big difference between the town Pashtun and the country Pashtun. And he was, you know, he might as well have been from London compared to the real, tribal people there. And that the government was really the alliance of the Hazaras, Uzbeks, and Tajiks. Is that, I'm just talking circa 2006 or something, that's just not true anymore, or was it ever?
I don't think it's true. I mean, I think that would have been more accurate early on after the invasion, but I think it's much simpler than even an ethnic question. It's that you have warlords that are killing people and torturing people, and they happen to be Pashtun warlords, actually. They're the main ones who are doing it. The Special Forces and the CIA are allying with, created a whole host of warlords across the Pashtun areas who themselves are Pashtuns and are doing the dirty work of the war on terror. And that's, I think that more than anything else is what's upset people and has mobilized them to fight against the Taliban. Mm-hmm. But, fight against the U.S. I mean, most of these people who are fighting now had actually, including the leadership, they had actually surrendered and quit back in 2001, 2002. Even Mullah Mansour, the new leader of the Taliban, he was sitting at home in Kandahar minding his own business, but the U.S. and the warlords kept raiding his house, so he fled to Pakistan and joined the Taliban.
Yeah. Now, that's, very important, and we've talked about that before. If people want to search the archives for previous interviews and certainly read and on about that, it's not just in the book, but you've written about that before, I think. my memory is correct, for the Christian Science Monitor and things like that, about how they really, they had even all signed on to a letter saying, hey, America, we recognize that you're the new big dogs here and we got to do what you say. So here we are. We've lined up for our instructions. What do you want us to do? And the Americans simply just made enemies out of them anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, man, it's amazing, isn't it? And now, man, I forgot what my one last awesome question was going to be, and I've got you over time now anyway. So thanks very much for your time, Anand. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, you too.
All right, y'all, that is Anand Gopal, and the article is, his book is No Good Men Among the Living, and you can find also this great interview of him here about the death of Mullah Omar at The Diplomat. And we'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up today is Anthony Weller. He is the editor of First Into Nagasaki. And it was written by his father, George Weller, who was literally the first into Nagasaki after the nuclear attack 70 years ago. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Anthony?
Thank you very much.
Good to have you back on the show. Been quite a while since we talked. Very important book here. Your father George Weller, was a reporter for the Chicago Daily News, correct?
That's right. For many, many years, for about four decades.
Mm-hmm. And I think, if I remember right, you told me before that he had covered World War II for quite a long time and all different theaters of battle leading up to before he was assigned to go to Japan. Is that right?
Sure. He started in Eastern Europe, then Africa, then Singapore.
I see.
And India, then the Middle East.
Mm. And, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He was all over the map.
All right, and now, so how did he get into Nagasaki after Truman nuked it?
Well, he was present at the surrender on the USS Missouri, where all the hundreds of journalists were forbidden by MacArthur to visit either nuclear site, and he saw that there was a press junket down to an abandoned kamikaze base that was on the island of Kyushu, and he guessed correctly that the Japanese railroads would still be functioning. So he got flown down to this place called Kanoya, which was essentially a non-story on a little airstrip island. And he connived with some locals to take him over by boat at dawn the next day from Kanoya, the island, to the mainland of Kyushu. And then he hopped a train War, Nagasaki in secret, which took him a day, and on the way, he promoted himself from a rather bedraggled war correspondent to a U.S. colonel. So he left the railroad station on the mainland near Kanoya as a Rumble journalist and arrived in Nagasaki as Colonel Weller. So that was his strategy.
Yeah, you told a funny story before about, and it's in the book, I believe in the introduction where you describe how he kind of BS'd his way in and said, yeah, that's right, I'm Colonel Weller's son, and just kind of buffaloed the local American officers, kind of bullied them into letting him in without checking.
Well, he bullied the local Japanese officers when he got into Nagasaki. The U.S. military was nowhere to be seen.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking that. I got the anecdote confused. It was the Japanese that he said, you don't want to double-check me.
That's exactly right.
Right, yeah. Well, and good enough for a good cause, for sure. And then, so, now we get to the subtitle of the book here, Anthony. And, of course, now I got to click a thing to get it right. It's First Into Nagasaki, The Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War, and that you edited your father's dispatches. How many, I'm thinking now the book is 300 pages or something. How many different dispatches, how much reporting did he actually do out of there that never saw the light of day until 2006?
Well, he had about 1 week in Nagasaki, and then 2 weeks in the prison camps. They were near Nagasaki. The whole point was that MacArthur wanted it all kept secret, partly because he wanted to be in control of Japan with his eyes on the White House, partly because he didn't want the world to see that even though we were no longer at war with Japan, the Americans were not sending any medical help to either atomic site. And the best thing to do was to keep the press out. And this MacArthur succeeded in doing so. All my dad's dispatches were duly sent to Tokyo by Japanese police envoys who my father had enlisted. Because remember, he was Colonel Weller.
Mm-hmm.
He was not only the highest ranking, but the only American officer who had appeared since Japan's capitulation. Was the first Yank they'd seen. The Americans had bombed the hell out of them. And the only person they'd sent was my dad, who was trying to order them around. So he was sending his daily reports, which were in fact articles, back to MacArthur's office in Tokyo to theoretically be stamped as approved and passed back to Chicago. Now, of course, MacArthur's office was throwing them into the nearest wastebasket. But that was the way it worked, and there was no, it was a different age. There was no way to bypass the censors, because then your newspaper would lose the all-important accreditation in a theater of war, meaning not only my dad, but no Chicago Daily News reporter would be permitted there. So that just wasn't feasible. Mm-hmm. Nobody remembers the Chicago Daily News now, but back then it had a bigger foreign service than even the New York Times. Mm-hmm. It was syndicated in 60 papers around America. So they had a big stake.
Right.
There was simply no way my dad could sneak the articles back to Chicago, and there was also no way to do it anyway. There weren't cell phones or internet back then. So he was writing these dispatches. He wrote enough to fill the book in about a 3-week period, and MacArthur censored it all.
Right. Now, we're in a commercial break right now, so would you like to take a break for a minute before we come back, or would you like to just go ahead and keep recording through?
No, that would be perfect.
Okay, great. So hang
I'll
tight right there.
Break.
Okay, great. And we'll come back. We'll be back at 47 minutes after.
Wait, so when are we back?
Oh, in 3 minutes.
Perfect.
At 47 after.
I get it. Break.
Okay, hang tight right there. We'll be right back. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Anthony Weller. He's the author of 4 novels, The Garden of the Peacocks, The Polish Lover, The Siege of Salt Cove, and The Land of Later On. He also is the editor of 2 books of his father's war reporting for the Chicago Daily News, his father, George Weller. First, Into Nagasaki, the censored eyewitness dispatches on post-atomic Japan and its prisoners of war. And Weller's War, a legendary foreign correspondent saga of World War II on 5 continents. So we're talking about how his father, George, was in fact the first Into Nagasaki, the first American to go and see the consequences, interview the survivors, witness the onset of radiation sickness, and the rest. So can you please tell us a little bit, Anthony, about what we'll find in this great book of your father's war reporting?
Well, you'll find his firsthand accounts of interviewing Japanese doctors who could see what was happening, but couldn't really understand it because, let's face it, nobody had seen it before. Especially troublesome was how certain patients would seem perfectly fine. Then they would do something innocuous like make a little cut in their finger while cutting a laminate lunch. And then they would just keep bleeding until they bled to death. This was a result of the atomic effect on the blood's ability to clot. Others felt some of what are now more familiar symptoms, where their stomachs would just feel heated up and suddenly as if their insides were burning. Then they would just die. My father referred to this as Disease X. Now, he had no sentimentality about it. He'd been covering the war with the Japanese in the Pacific for several years, and he felt it was extraordinarily unfair, to say the least, that Americans were dying, not as old men in Key West, but as young men on the beaches of the Solomon Islands. However, he could feel, as he put it, pity but no remorse. And as he pointed out, even then, the firebombings of Tokyo, which he had written about just the month before, had killed just as many people, if not more. By the way, napalm was developed for those firebombings, but nobody really writes about them. He saw the atomic bomb as an extreme instrument of war. But remember, Nagasaki was different in many ways from Hiroshima. Hiroshima was steamrollered out of existence because of the nature of Nagasaki. It's not flat, but a series of hills. There was a kind of fireball that bounced like a basketball from hill to hill, starting fires all over the place. They could not be put out because all the houses were wood. Like Hiroshima, and all clear it sounded. In the air raid warning sirens. So people were going about their daily business, which was making lunch at home. So the bomb exploded overhead, and hundreds and hundreds of little fires were started in this wooden town. Caught fire. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the tragic legacy of the whole thing. You know, Ralph Rako, the historian, asks, well, if the Americans had sent in the Marines to round up all the men, women, and children of Nagasaki and just machine gun them all to death like the German Gestapo would have done, would that have been okay? In order to force their government to capitulate. And I don't think most people would say that it would be okay to machine gun all their men, women, children. But somehow dropping a bomb on them from the air and killing 100,000 at once, and as you say, in fires, you know, later that day, and the radiation sickness and whatever, somehow that seems cleaner and somehow okay, because it's just one blow instead of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of bullets having to be fired, I guess. But anyway, I guess I understand what you're saying about your father's point of view at the time was widely shared that, you know, they, you know, overall had it coming, Although, you know, I'm not so sure that really applies when they is a town full of civilians with no military assets and other than a POW base, right? Doesn't your dad write about the American POWs there who survived the nuking?
Well, there were a number of POW camps nearby. I mean, Nagasaki was a pretty flourishing armaments town. There was a submarine factory within it, and you could argue, as many historians have, that part of the Japanese strategy was to place its armaments complexes in the heart of city, so that the question of attacking military targets would be all wrapped up with the question of doing harm to civilians. The great legacy of World War II, unfortunately, is that civilians in Europe and Asia became targets for the first time. That's the real innovation, if you will, of World War II over World War I.
Yeah.
The days of marching armies out to occupy trenches and kill tens of thousands of men to advance 5 feet. We're now over. Now you could bomb cities and do a lot more damage that way. It's pretty sad, I'm afraid.
Mm.
But that's the legacy of World War II.
And it seems important, if I remember right in the book, Anthony, you talk about how the cover-up of and the suppression, censorship of your father's work, for one example, and there was other footage that was taken and other films and different parts of the story, but that ultimately the censorship overall really led to worse deaths for many of the victims of the radiation sickness, the Disease X, as your father termed it. Because if people had known, then, you know, Red Cross would have come, done something, give them a little bit of morphine as they die or whatever. I don't know if they could have made too much difference, but seems like, you know, certainly they didn't make things better by keeping the results a secret.
Of course not. And the important lesson is that all censorship is fundamentally propaganda, and the moment when something could have been understood or is now lost forever and will never return. So I think what my father felt was that the American people deserved to know what had been done. And they were not given that opportunity. You know, one thing he said in another book was that it's through knowing the truth that the people discover their hidden will. Asia was the kindergarten of American geopolitics. It's where Americans have the chance to grow up and learn that the simple life of playing in the mud in the garden was gone forever. And here was their chance to grow up. And the Americans didn't grow up, did they? Not until Vietnam was there. Beginning of manhood or adulthood, the beginning of reality, the beginning of an education. So So he felt very angry that his dispatches were silenced, and indeed he died believing them lost forever.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that part of the story, that it wasn't until after he died that you found them in the attic. And he had forgotten, I guess, that he had kept copies.
Absolutely. And indeed, I found them purely by chance. And of course, I knew what they were. But a Japanese film crew had visited me only 6 months earlier to do a whole documentary about this very story. And I was forced to tell them that indeed they hadn't come to light in 55 years. And the maker of the documentary had been down to the War Office, not the War Office, the National Archives in Washington, to see if the copies might have survived there, but they had not. MacArthur had very efficiently destroyed them. So that was that, and then I found them by accident.
Well, it's sure, a good thing you did. It's a great story about how you found them, and of course, a very important story told in the book. And I want to thank you for coming back on the show to talk about it with us again, Anthony.
I want to thank you for remembering. 70 years is a long time.
Yeah, well, as you said, it's among the most important of lessons to be learned here from this story. So,
I couldn't agree more.
All right, everybody, that is Anthony Weller. He is the editor of First Into Nagasaki, the Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War, the dispatches for the Chicago Daily News, censored dispatches for the Chicago Daily News by his Pulitzer Prize-winning father, George Weller, and also Weller's War, a Legendary Foreign Correspondent Saga of World War II on Five Continents, and a handful of novels, too. Check out his website at anthonyweller.com. And that's it for the show. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow.